Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. This is episode 101 of the program. I can't even believe it. Some of you are thinking, who celebrates 101? Why did you miss 100? Were you napping? No, it's just we kind of like to do things differently around here. Everybody marks the 100th anniversary of something. Besides, I like Dalmatians. So we're celebrating 101 episodes of Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up this week, how money became dangerous. Dangerous? Yeah. Chris Farrellis is the author of How Money Became Dangerous, the inside story of our turbulent relationship with modern finance. I'll ask him just what he means and what you can do about it. Then, themed retirement communities for retired teachers, for nuns, and for nudists. We'll talk to Sue Johansson about these specialty retirement residences. She's with A Place for Mom. And curious about how much you're actually worth? Fred Conje, also known as Prairie Fire, will join us to tell you why you should calculate your net worth and how you should go about doing it. Plus, Melissa Shin from Advisor's Edge will be here to talk about the decade ahead in the financial advice industry. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Money used to be so simple back in the day. You know, you'd have like a little passbook for your bank account. Maybe you'd have a mortgage and, you know, some investments or a pension. And that was about it. Technology has changed things. The complexity in the market has changed. Everything has become much more complex. Chris Farrellis is the founding partner of Riverwood Capital and the author of How Money Became Dangerous, the inside story of our turbulent relationship with modern finance. He joins us now from California to talk about the book and his three action items for financial reform. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
Dangerous is a very strong word. What do you mean when you use the word dangerous?
Well, we've seen over the past generation, we've seen complexity go up while we've seen accountability and connectivity going down. And when those two trends continue and diverge, it creates for potentially dangerous things to happen as we see bubbles form, we see our connectivity drop and accountability drop, and there's many facets of the industry we no longer understand or appreciate.
Yeah. Can you give us some examples that would apply to, you know, a regular consumer who's not trading high risk, you know, derivatives and puts and calls and options and stuff? What would have that be? What would be some real examples for them?
Well, the one that's going to hit you, whether you have it or not, is the pension system. So we see pensions growing. They're not funded. They continue to be underfunded. And we see more and more of the promises and the checks that we're promising in the future that we can't pay or we don't really have a path to pay. We've heard about the entitlement system, of course. But we've seen in the government employee sector pension funds that are 60% funded, you know, on average, but we, you know, Puerto Rico was one. The non-uniform personnel were 1% funded. That pension was 1% funded at the time of the bankruptcy. We've also seen it in our social world. We see more and more where technology is eliminating the need for us to do commerce one-on-one or go into our communities and interact. You know, for better or for worse, commerce is the place where humanity and friction took place and forced us to exchange thoughts and ideas and interactions, and that's being eliminated from the system.
You spent a lot of time in the financial services industry. Why did you decide to write this book? Was there a sudden epiphany? Did you have a walk in the snow? Did you do the Camino or something?
Well, first of all, chapter one's a great story, and it's one of those stories where everyone said, you just have to write it down, and that happened to me when I was a commercial banking officer in the mid-'80s, my first job, and that sort of started me down the path of chronicling and tracking and journaling. But then I realized as I worked in, and I've been fortunate to work in almost every facet of the finance industry, I kept realizing, well, this is a very dynamic industry that's changing. And as it changes, we're reaching for more efficiency, more scope, and more reach. But with it, we're losing control along the way and accountability. So we're losing characters being taken out of the system, accountability is taken out of the system, mission is taken out of the system, time is compressed. You know, all of these forces which, you know, together create a very challenging dynamic for those that work in the industry or those that, you know, which is all of us are taught. I think it's the most important part of our lives that we know so little about.
You have three action items for what you call financial reform. Now, obviously, the financial system is different in the United States compared to Canada in many ways, not all, but in many ways. How would you talk about those three action items? What is a regular person with a regular job who isn't a politician or a regulator? What are they to do?
Well, first off, I say, is there a part of your life that is so important they know so little about? Where do we learn about finance? Where do we learn? It seems like, you know, my daughter learns about everything in school but finance, but yet, you know, she's put out there in the world. So first of all, don't be afraid to engage, because I think fear prevents us from doing so. That's one. And, you know, understand what you're buying, understand what you own. Don't take a, I'm just going to step back. So, you know, obviously you're part of your mission, and you're helping
it
in
is
that cause. The second is challenge leadership. I don't hear any, you know, in all this political debate, I don't hear anybody saying, hey, what are you doing about the underfunded pension system? What are you doing about these entitlement programs? What are you doing about the community impact of the financial world? I don't see that debate happening. So, you know, next time you have the opportunity to raise your hand and ask a question, I'm not saying all the other questions aren't important, but where is that challenge coming from? How are we holding them accountable? They're making decisions which have impacts beyond their term of office, and this is one of the biggest problems. We have an antiquated financial system that is not aligned with the political structure. It's become very complicated beyond, you know, the typical legislative process. So next time you meet with anyone of an authority, ask them a finance question, because if we don't hold them accountable, they're going to continue to write checks and make promises that they don't have to worry about keeping because it's beyond their term of office.
I want to talk about one of the big technological shifts that we're seeing culturally, and that is the move of commerce to the cloud. You have an interesting take on that evolution and how that affects regular people. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, we talk a lot about technology, but at the end of the day, when you really look at the big tech apps that we love, whether it's Amazon or Uber or whatever, it's really about the movement of money and the movement of commerce and making the payment more and more efficient. And the more, you know, I always say technology is almost a way by which we can arrange the world so we don't have to interact with one another. And so, because that limits and minimizes our need to interact with people less like ourselves, that just reinforces the, we all know about the bubble mentality and the echo chamber and the fact that, you know, we can choose our world and choose who we're in, when not too long ago we were forced together and made to interact. So the financial moving to the cloud and the financial e-commerce world, it's serving to reinforce that bubble and reinforce the selection into what groups we participate in. And as a result, it allows us to really homogenize and solidify our worldview without really a challenge. Like, where does that challenge come from? You can't even debate the store owner or the taxi driver, you know, whomever it may be. That's just not there anymore.
Interesting stuff. Well, thank you for your insight, both in this conversation and in the book itself. We appreciate it.
Thanks for what you do. Thanks, Bruce.
Chris Varelas is the author of How Money Became Dangerous, the inside story of our turbulent relationship with modern finance. Coming up next, Fred Conje. He's also known as Prairie Fire, and he's here to tell you why you should be tracking your net worth. Then later, a look at themed retirement communities. Sue Johansson will be here. She's with A Place for Mom, and she's got some pretty interesting examples, ones that I hadn't even heard of, like for, you know, alumni groups at universities, for retired teachers, for nuns. Don't forget, we've got a newsletter that brings together all sorts of fun stuff that I've done on this show and on my financial advisor's podcast called Prosper, plus the columns that I do for CBC Radio, Cityline, and Yahoo Finance. You can sign up for it at moolala.ca. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
When you hear the phrase net worth, it's usually in the context of uber-rich celebrities or CEOs and their outstanding and ridiculously high net worths. But everyone has a net worth. Everyone's got one. It could be positive, it could be negative, but you got one. And according to Fred Conje, also known as Prairie Fire, you should calculate yours. He joins us now from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, to go over the calculation and to tell us what he discovered after calculating his own net worth. Hey, Fred.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
I have been calculating my net worth since 2001, and I have changed computers many, many times, so I am grateful that I got printed out the piece of paper every time and have them in a file. I've moved like six times. I've kept the file. I've written about net worth in both my books. I am a very big believer. You are a believer. Why?
I think the big thing for me, I'm like the average person who is running through life and haven't really paid much attention to their finances. And then when I finally took the time to take a look, I felt like it was a story of how I lived financially. And I found it really informative in being able to understand where I'm at and also to achieve my financial goals.
That's great. For some people, the calculation might not be familiar. So let's have you define it. What is it? How do you calculate it?
It's a relatively easy formula. It involves two variables. One is assets. So that's basically the things that you own that have value, specifically a dollar value that you can actually sell. That includes something, what we call liquids, so something they could sell quite quickly, such as like a vehicle. But it could be also illiquid, something like your house, and includes things like cash as well. And so you have your assets or things that you own, and then finally you also have your liabilities. So that's basically the things that you owe money for. So that can include your debt specifically. It could be a credit card. It could be your mortgage. It could be a loan on your vehicle, anything like that where you owe money and you have to pay it back over time. And so you got assets, liabilities, and the net worth is the difference between them. So assets minus liabilities equals net worth.
Right. And if you're someone graduating from some sort of post-secondary education and you do the calculation, it is highly likely it will be a negative number. And if you're 75 years old, you've worked all your life and you own your house outright, it is likely it will be a positive number. Is that a fair summary?
That's pretty fair. Net worth is a number of an indicator where you're at. Remember, it's net worth, not self-worth.
Oh, good distinction. What do you mean by that?
Well, a lot of people look at the negative number and may feel down about it. And I think it's important for people to understand that it's a snapshot and it tells your story. And you can change that story and take the steps to improve your net worth and also to be able to understand that you are valuable as a person as well outside of that number.
When you started tracking your net worth, you discovered some what you call personal truths. What are they?
I think one of the big things is that when I took a look at my net worth, I realized the importance of understanding what assets are and that in the big picture, we're sort of playing what I like to call the asset collection game. And these assets are either have a lot of value or provide some kind of cash flow over time. This could be something as simple as stocks and bonds. It could be a rental property. It could be your own house. And so being able to collect the right assets plays a really important role in being able to achieve your financial goal. One big thing for me and what I write in my blog, prairiefirecanada.ca, is really focusing on achieving financial independence. And I see the assets as important to getting to that particular area in life where I feel like I can either retire early or decide to do something else with my life. And so that was very insightful for me and also understanding what I owe. Like I said, when you're busy and you have your day-to-day, sometimes you lose track of those things. It's important to have that centralized and keep track of it. And that's another thing you can control is to be able to have a plan to pay that down. But if you don't know how much you owe, you can't make a plan to get there.
One of the sources of confusion around net worth, in particular for those who live in high-priced real estate markets, is the inflation in their net worth simply because the housing market has been on such a tear. So you look at the net worth, it's like, oh, my God, and it's doubled. But it's entirely a function of the house that you have owned. And that's a challenge because you're going to need a roof over your head. And if you retire and don't downsize to something much cheaper, then it doesn't matter how much your net worth has grown because you don't have access to that money. Talk a bit about that pitfall or some of the other pitfalls that people should keep in mind as they look at that total.
That's a really good point, especially with real estate at where we're at right now. And being understand that, once again, this is a snapshot and each item on your assets has a particular meaning. So if you have bought in a good time and prices are going up, realize that you are perhaps wealthy on paper, not necessarily financially independent. And when you do sell your home, like you said, you have to find a home as well when you actually have to find a place to live. So one of the things as part of your plan is making sure not getting trapped in that, you know, euphoria of feeling wealthy and having a good definition of wealth when it comes to being able to understand what your needs are and your goals are. I think another thing that really confuses people is debt and how that works and the impact it has over the long term. Some people may be confused is, you know, if I have savings at the month, should I pay off debt or should I invest or should I put it towards savings towards a particular goal? And once again, it's really important to have that big picture of knowing what your personal goals are, but also understanding your debt. If it's high interest, more than likely you're better off paying off your debt as fast as possible. There's a lot of charges that come with it, but also restricting your access to debt. So, for example, if you have a credit card and you get that letter in the mail that you've been you got up to an extra $2,000 or $3,000.
No, thank you.
Exactly. How is that going to affect your behavior in your life and achieving your goals? So net worth is part of the big picture, and it allows you to see where you're at specifically when it comes to those tough decisions and getting that idea there.
One of the things I'm also a huge fan of is looking at the trend lines, which people won't have if they're just, you know, they're going to listen to this conversation and do it this year. But if you do it over the course of time, you can start to isolate the variables. And, you know, some people will see, geez, I had $5,000 outstanding on all my credit cards last year and the year before and the year before that, and I have made no progress on that. So if you only look at the net worth total and all the gain is on your house, you're missing such a huge opportunity to eliminate your consumer debt. So there's something really compelling about the trends there too, right?
Most definitely. When you look at those particular items, like you said, I sort of see them as some things you can control, such as how much debt you have, and some things you can't control, like the stock market, right? Those things are sort of out of your hands. So I see the things that you can control sort of as levers to get you to your goal. So if you do have savings at the end of the month, you can control how much that's going to be and where you want to put it to improve your net worth. Or if you do have debt that you want to deal with, being able to address that right away to improve your net worth as well as part of that formula that we were talking about, and just being part of that whole larger strategy of trying to reach financial independence.
Really helpful stuff. Fred, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
And your website is, where should we direct people?
I'm located at prairiefirecanada.ca.
Prairiefirecanada.ca. Fred Conjay, thanks so much. He joined us from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan today. Next on Moolala, many, many of you work with financial advisors. The industry has gone through a lot of change in the last decade. So what's ahead in the next one? We'll talk to Melissa Shin from Advisors Edge. Then later in the program, Sue Johansson, the Vice President of Partner Services at A Place for Mom, is here to tell us about the latest retirement trend, specialty retirement residences. So cool. Hey, want to join in the conversation? Connect with me on social media, at Bruce Selry Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. And you never need miss an episode of Moolala again. You can go to our website, moolala.ca, or head over to iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever your podcast platform is, and listen to past episodes, either the full show or individual segments. Write a review, subscribe. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Moolala has listeners of all ages and stages from across the country in all fields of work. One group of listeners are financial advisors. These are people who work every day trying to help Canadians get a better handle on their money. And it hasn't been an easy go in the last decade, except for perhaps the strength in the stock market. But what does the next decade hold for the industry? Today is the first in a multi-part series for financial advisors that we've developed in partnership with Prosper, the financial advisors podcast that I host for Advisor's Edge. We're going to talk to a number of stakeholders. We're going to talk to FP Canada, Advocus, Fair Canada, and Advisor's Edge about what to expect in the financial advice industry over the next 10 years. Joining us now is Melissa Shin. She is the editorial director at Advisor's Edge and investment executive. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
You have covered this industry for a very long time. How would you characterize the state of things today at the beginning of a new decade?
So the way I would describe it is that everything has changed and nothing has changed. We actually had the 20th anniversary of Advisor's Edge a couple of years ago.
Wow.
And we looked at the 1998 issue, and a lot of the words in there are very relevant today. So it's quite interesting because a lot of the conversations about regulation, about the role of the advisor, about trying to find value in financial advice and not just having it be about investments, that is still the same. But technology has really changed how business works. We have seen, obviously, the rise of the robo-advisor, the rise of ETFs, and certainly a lot of consolidation in the industry as well. A lot of the companies that used to exist 10, 20 years ago, they don't exist anymore.
What are two or three factors from the past decade that you would say inform your view of where things are headed? So just to get us kind of set for this look ahead, what are some of the big themes that you think are going to be really relevant?
Sure. So as I mentioned, the industry consolidation aspect of it and the way that people pay for advice. So looking at some of the stats for the last 10 years from the Investment Industry Association of Canada, we have seen 100 firms close or resign from 2009 to 2018.
Wow.
And we've also seen commission revenue flat since 2009.
Hmm.
So that's been really a big shift. And yet fee revenue has risen 350% over that same period.
Wow. Now, the markets have been very, very strong. So
yes,
if it's a percentage of total assets under management in aggregate, that would make sense that it would be a significant increase.
Yes, but I think the way that advisors are having conversations with clients and the way that clients want to pay for advice is changing. Some would argue that it's not changing quickly enough. Advisors are realizing that there's a lot of regulation pressure, that they have to do a lot to be compliant. And therefore, it might be easier to have a fee structure where they can work with their clients and have them pay directly for the advice that they're being given, as opposed to having it bundled in with product. And then on the flip side of it, there's a huge understanding now amongst investors about the fact that, you know, investing can be expensive. And for some people, that it's just they've heard that, you know, oh, there are these fees that I have to pay. I don't really understand how that works. And then others who have really, thanks to a lot of the investor advocates, are starting to understand the fact that they are actually paying for advice and they don't realize it in some of the products that they've been buying, like mutual funds.
And that at its best, people are aware of all that and then make a choice such that they ensure that they get value for the advice that they're paying for.
Yes,
they need to know that they're paying for it and then advocate for themselves to ensure they're getting value for it.
Exactly. And great advisors realize that they're not just transactional for their clients. They're helping them with their whole lives. They're helping them with, maybe buying a home, estate planning, their taxes, passing on a business. Some people call their advisors when, you know, their kids need to find a job and they just want some advice. They want to switch careers and they want some ideas about a business coach or something like that. People might call their advisors for that. So they're really now being seen as concierges for people's entire lives, not just financial.
So the three ways that advisors have been paid historically, commission-based, as you mentioned, fee-based, which is a smaller subset currently, but growing, and fee-only, much, much smaller, also growing. Then there is this, and I've just seen this quite recently, is the subscription-based model. Tell us a bit about that and whether or not you think that's going to get traction in the decade ahead.
Yeah, so that's not, to your point, it's not very common right now. I don't actually know if any firms are doing it here in Canada.
Kind Wealth, I think, is the one that I've heard. Kind Wealth, but it was really the first one.
Okay. So as we know, as consumers, you know, it's a lot easier to just have something come off your credit card, like your Netflix subscription or your Amazon Prime. And what we've even seen with those is the increase of value that you get. So it used to be that Amazon Prime just got you delivery. Mm. And now you also get to watch all these
movies. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yes, exactly. Or Fleabag.
Jack Ryan or Fleabag. Fleabag. I think most importantly, Fleabag.
Absolutely. So, that has really helped people understand that there is value in paying for something. And to my point earlier, it used to be that people didn't realize that they were paying for advice.
Right.
They thought it was free. They thought it just kind of came with the product. Yeah. And in some case, it did, or they weren't getting it. And it's the same thing with media. You know, people were streaming movies and they weren't necessarily paying for it. But Netflix has changed that and allowed people to just have something come off their account, and then they get it every month. So this could be a way to reach those consumers who maybe don't feel comfortable writing a check to their advisor. There's often a lot of advisors say, I'm not sure that I can work with my clients and have them write a check to me because, you know, that's just not how they want to work.
Right.
But having something a little bit more automated, a bit more similar to how they work with other service providers in their life, may show that value. Mm.
How they are paid and then where they work. One of the trends that we've seen in a number of industries, and really it hasn't been the last 5 years, it's been the last 20 years, is companies really considering their real estate footprint and enabling their employees to work in lots of different places, the mobile worker. Financial advisors outside of rural communities, like those who work in urban centers, typically trek to an office. Will we see more options for advisors in the decade ahead in terms of working in different places or at least working differently?
Yes, I think so. I think that is in conjunction with the fact that consumers, clients are demanding more options from their advisors as well. So to your point, there's been a lot of kitchen table meetings in rural areas because people live so far apart, they don't want to go visit their advisor. Well, even in an urban center, finding parking is a challenge. People are getting older and they don't want to drive. The weather's not always great. And especially if they have a long-standing relationship with their advisor, there might not be that need to meet face-to-face. Technology, as we know, has improved to the point where everybody has a webcam on their computer.
Right.
And, you don't have that lagginess when you do a video chat or something like that. And, you know, grandparents are FaceTiming their grandkids. So there's certainly that baked-in technological comfort that clients will now have. So, you know, we actually feel that advisors can get away eventually without necessarily having a bricks and mortar office. And in fact, there's a Canadian company called LiveCA. It is a for chartered accountants, and they actually don't have a physical office. They will call you. They might come to you, but in any case, they don't have a physical office. And so that's something that advisors might be able to get to.
Well, and certainly a big cohort of advisors will retire in the decade ahead. People retire all the time, every day, but we're in this demographic shift that we've been talking about in so many parts of the economy. Financial advisory is not immune from that. What do you see in terms of that kind of transformation? Are so many people going to retire that it's going to be hard to sell your book?
It might be. And that's something that advisors really need to plan for, because a lot of them count on their books as their retirement
plan. Their retirement plan,
right. That's going to be how they make enough money.
Their clients consider their house the retirement plan, and advisors might say that that's one huge asset for them.
Sure. So we've seen the demographic effects of the baby boom, you know, throughout the years, and this will be another one where the baby boom advisors are retiring and their clients are also retiring. So their clients are retiring, chances are they are drawing down from their nest egg. So if your book is a whole bunch of retirees and you're retiring, you might be sort of in that crunch where your book is going to be worth less and you don't have anybody to sell it to. And there's also a dearth of advisors entering the industry because it's a really tough one.
Mm. Big data is a buzzy phrase in our culture right now and has been for the last couple of years. It's huge in retail and logistics and agriculture. What do you think it means for financial advice?
So in the near term, I think it means better financial advice because the advisor will know a lot more about their clients. So, for example, my financial advisor has said, please tell me what you spend money on, or you could export your credit card data into this CSV file and upload it to our system, and we will analyze it for
really?
You. Yeah, it's a little creepy. I chose not to do that, but yeah. but you know, a lot of banks now, their interface allows for classifying your expenses, and we all know through diet and exercise, people self-reporting, they don't do a great job of that. We're just not very good at tracking ourselves, and so the data will allow for that to happen, and financial advisors get a much better sense of what their clients are doing, and it's more about what I do, not what I say.
One of the things that people are doing more is investing in socially responsible funds. They have been around for decades. I mean, I've been covering this industry for literally since 1998, and there have been products for that period of time, but it really seems only recently that it has crossed over into the mass market. What's your prediction for the decade ahead? Is now the time in which, whatever you call them, climate change, socially responsible, impact investing, those all those ideas will cross over into the mainstream?
I'd argue in some case that it has. We all followed Greta. She came across the ocean. So there is this understanding of the importance of environmental and social issues. Unfortunately, we've not seen that translate as well into assets under management.
Yeah, it's not a huge part of the share.
No. And part of the reason for that is the fact that everybody defines responsible investing differently, and they even use different terms for it. So it's hard to create a product that everybody can get behind, because if I don't like tobacco and oil, but you feel that all companies should be run by women, then we might not have an overlapping
agreement.
There's
only three companies left in the universe.
So that's a challenge. So now one thing that has been proposed to the federal government is that there be a tax credit for low carbon investments. So however that gets defined. And what it would mean would be increased RRSP room for people who choose to invest in these low carbon investments. So that's a proposal.
Yeah. An interesting one with limits, because so few Canadians actually max out their RRSPs to begin with.
That's true. And so it would at first benefit rich people.
Yeah.
But in any case, it would certainly change the definition out there. Well, it would create a definition out there that a lot of the product manufacturers would then most likely start to shift toward. And back in 2005, they lifted the foreign investment cap on RRSPs. So this could have a similar effect of sort of creating a wave of investment towards something else. Now, it's interesting about that, because I just saw someone posted some data saying that despite that change now almost 15 years ago, we have actually not seen that much increase in foreign content in RSP. So who knows?
Canadians still love to keep their money at home. And maybe that's habit. Maybe, I don't know what it's, I don't know if it's patriotism. It's not the smartest thing to do. I want to ask you about the market segmentation, because there has been such a push really in the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 years on the high net worth client. Even organizations that haven't historically targeted that segment have gone hard on that segment. So tons of competition for high net worth, lot of competition on the robo front, which is the, the younger investor in the smaller account size. It seems like no one wants the middle, that mass consumer who's got, I don't know, like 100 grand, not 500 grand and not 10 grand. Are they going to be left in the dust, or will there be a firm or firms who decide that's a segment worth fighting for?
Wherever there is risk, there's also opportunity. I think that the challenge is that you're right. The large firms don't necessarily find it profitable to go after that group of people. And for the robos that can do an excellent job with people with low assets, maybe the people in that realm are better served with more information than just a robo can give. So I think what we might see is that some of the robos will up their game and provide more support in areas like tax and estate planning or budgeting, or areas that those people with the $250,000 in assets need help with, but don't have enough money to attract the attention of someone who serves high net worth clients. And we also may see more salaried advisors come into play. So people who don't necessarily need to have rich clients in order to make a living. And then that way, those folks will be able to be served.
Is that, when you say salaried advisors, is that currently what we would see at a bank? When you go to a bank branch?
it's starting to be more prominent. So yes, you see there's sort of different, depends on what floor you enter at the bank.
Right.
So you come in on the first floor, yes, you're going to see people who make a salary and might get a bonus. If you go upstairs, you're going to work with someone who's more being paid fee-based as a percentage of the assets that you have, etc. So we may see more of those salaried advisors come into play. Traditionally, that's not been maybe the most exciting for a budding financial advisor, because there's this definitely a lot more upside if you're being paid as a percentage of assets. However, as I mentioned earlier, there is sort of this challenge in terms of recruitment. It's very risky to have to eat what you kill, as they call it.
Yep.
And if you find it challenging to find clients, or you don't really want to be a salesperson, which is certainly where we're trying to move the business away from, you just want to serve clients, and maybe the clients can come to you. The trade-off is that you're not going to maybe make as much money, right, but you'll probably still make a pretty good living.
I want to come back to the regulatory conversation, because you have talked endlessly. I have talked endlessly about CRM2. That's now a while in the past. Is there a CRM 3, 4, 5, 6, 7? What's the roadmap, broadly speaking, on things to watch out for from a regulatory perspective?
CRM2 is largely a disclosure initiative, so that it helps people see on their statements how much they are paying for their investments. Now, that is not been necessarily the game changer that everybody thought it would be, in the sense that, yes, there have certainly been some rude awakenings for some clients, but at the same time, everybody is just overwhelmed with the amount of disclosure documents they have to read.
Yeah.
You know, I don't read a end user license agreement when I buy software.
What? Come on.
Sorry.
Yeah, I don't either. And you and I are following this all the time, and we don't read it.
Exactly. So, you know, is the answer more disclosure, or is the answer a more systemic change in the industry from a regulation perspective? And, you know, I say this in thinking about the next 10 years. Well, it's, you know, it was 1995 when a report came out suggesting that we look at embedded commissions and maybe get rid of them. And we're not there yet. Mm. We've barely made movement on the deferred sales commissions. We've barely made movement on the deferred sales charges. Mm. There's a proposal to ban them, but it's stalled. So we don't know exactly where that will end up, but in any case, we could be having this same conversation in 2029.
Yeah. It's an exciting future. I feel excited. Do you feel excited?
I do. You know what? There's this great need for financial literacy and financial advice. And as we know, Canadians are going to be retiring. They are retiring in large numbers. And because of the way demographics work, we don't have that commensurate large number of people entering the workforce. So we need to figure out what's next. You know, the markets maybe aren't going to return as amazingly as they have in the last 10 years. Mm. So people need help, and there's debt and everything like that. So there's a huge opportunity for people who understand what clients need and can help them. And I just hope that the regulatory and the firm infrastructure does allow them to do that.
I hope so too. Melissa, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
Melissa Shin, Editorial Director with Advisors Edge and Investment Executive. And that's her 2 cents on the decade ahead in the financial advice industry.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Jimmy Buffett is opening up a Margaritaville-themed retirement residence. There are places that serve alumni of certain universities. There's retirement residences for retired teachers, retired nuns, former stars of stage and silver screen, and even, I found one online, even for nudists. Sue Johansson is Vice President of Partner Services at A Place for Mom, and she's here to talk about this big idea of themed retirement communities. She joins us from San Francisco. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
This is more prominent of an idea in the United States, at least from my online research. Can you give us some examples of themed retirement residences that you've come across? Or did I just hit off all the interesting ones in my introduction there? Is that all there is to say?
No, absolutely not. Really, you know, senior living is about having seniors transition in the most comfortable way possible. So having themed senior living communities helps seniors feel more at home with other like-minded seniors, obviously. And so there are senior communities who have high concentration of pets for those seniors who are pet lovers. There are senior communities with an artistic bend. There are senior communities who serve the LGBTQ community, and many senior communities that are affiliated with universities so that they can take advantage of, you know, some of the lectures that the universities offer. In addition, many of the communities offer university students the opportunity to get hands-on experience. So it's a great mix of young, vital energy from the students at the universities, getting real hand experience with seniors, and having the seniors be exposed to people who are passionate about working with them. So it really for a great dynamic.
Do you have any idea what market share these themed retirement residencies would have in the U.S.? Because I think for the most part, when I'm a Gen Xer, when my generation thinks about where our parents are going to be, really, it just seems like, where are we going to be able to find a spot, let alone a spot that allows for pets and university lectures?
Well, it's really becoming, you know, more prominent than you might think. You know, if you look at all the specialty senior living communities and you include things like university affiliated and pets and things like that, it's probably 40 to 50% of the marketplace right now. And senior living has changed so much in the last 10 years. There are luxury communities opening all the time that are really springing up to serve the baby boomer generation, which is just beginning to enter into retirement and senior living communities. So anything from virtual reality theaters to sushi bars, you know, really anything that you can think of. I was at a community and the virtual reality theater was focused on a trip to Italy. And of course, then their dining room featured all Italian meals that evening. So it really is not your grandmother's senior living any longer.
It sounds like what we would think of as a cruise ship these days in terms of amenities and entertainment. What is the cost paradigm when you start theming? Is it more, same, or less? And I know I'm asking you to generalize, which is an impossible thing to do given the range.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, it depends on what it is again. So for pets, for instance, there are senior living communities at all levels that accept pets. When you start talking about things like virtual reality theaters or, you know, lectures from Stanford University, those kinds of things, they tend to be affiliated with more upscale communities. So, you know, the more upscale the amenities, like on a cruise ship, usually the more expensive the overall experience would be. But I would say that usually you can find something appropriate at all levels, depending on kind of the individual niche that you're looking for.
Do these themed residences, are they able to offer the same promise of continuity of care? And I ask because for a lot of seniors, they really need to be able to progress through the various stages that may be connected to their health. And I think it would be dislocating for some to be, woo, I'm with my university alumni, and then all of a sudden I'm in, you know, a very, very different scenario because of the dementia that I'm dealing with. How does continuity of care work in this environment?
Yeah, I think aging in place, which is kind of what you're talking about, is really important. And so, again, such a variety of options out there. I think really, you know, the best thing to do for a senior looking for the right environment is to tour. And one of the things that you want to make sure you do is ask all the right questions. You know, A Place for Mom offers a document, and you can get them at a lot of places, that's called a Tips for Touring. You really want to find out when you tour someplace if you feel that affinity, if you feel like it's the right environment. And you want to prepare for the future. So you want to ask, do they have a memory care, you know, neighborhood in the community? Can they handle high acuity care? You know, what are the programs that the property offers for increased levels of care as a senior ages? And so I think they're not mutually exclusive. I think, again, it's community specific, but you want to make sure that you find those niche communities that fit from a lifestyle standpoint, and then ask the right questions about care so that you make ultimately the right decision.
When is the right time to do those tours? And I ask because if it's too early, there's a risk for the kids that the parents are going to think like they're trying to shovel them off somewhere. And if it's too late, it may be that, you know, we needed a spot yesterday and there isn't a spot, or, you know, it's harder to settle in at later periods in life for a whole bunch of reasons. Right. What wisdom would you have for when those tours should happen?
My philosophy is, and our philosophy at A Place for Mom is, that it's never too early to have the conversation with your parents, and it's never too early to tour. Better to have a solid plan in place so that everybody knows when you don't have any cognitive issues, when you've got your health, you're making great decisions, but also plan for what those milestone markers are. Oftentimes people will say, oh, at the death of a spouse, I don't want to live alone any longer, or when I can no longer drive, it's appropriate for me to move. So have the conversations early, set what your priorities are, and then be realistic about setting some milestones that may be time for you to make the move. People need to plan for those things. And as you said, the earlier a senior can transition into senior living, the more that they're going to get the benefit. If you wait until somebody is very sick, very high acuity care, it's a very difficult time to transition. And there are, of course, all kinds of stats about why communal living is positive for seniors and the benefits they get from socialization, cognitive stimulation, the proper diet, medication management. All of those things are key to helping seniors live better longer.
How does A Place for Mom work? Do your associates visit residences, themed or otherwise? How do they make their recommendations, and how does your company make its money?
Sure. So we have senior living advisors that are local to their communities all across the country.
Canada as well? Canada and the U.S.?
Canada as well. Exactly. Yep. Canada and the U.S. They go out to local communities. They get to know them. They work with seniors and the advisors at the communities all the time. So they've got great relationships. We have a CRM program that allows partners, the communities, to update things like activity schedules and menus. And so we keep really tuned into what the partners offer. We are free families throughout the U.S. and Canada, and we are paid from a partner community when a resident moves in. And also our employees are not incented to earn more when they refer somebody to a very high-end community or a very low-end community. They are neutral to where that family ends up moving. So it allows us to be kind of third-party experts and not tied to any one particular community type.
Now, would that necessitate that you have relationships with every single community out there, wouldn't it? Or are there some communities that you wouldn't refer to because you don't have that relationship?
Well, both is true. So we don't work with every single community out there. We have a pretty pretty thorough licensing vetting. So we work only with licensed communities that don't have infractions from the state. So we keep current with our standards as well. And then there are some communities that tend to be constantly full that may not engage with us. In the U.S., I think we're at about 86% of all communities in the United States, and in Canada, we're newer to Canada, so I think it's roughly around 70%.
What are the risk factors of themed retirement residences? And what I mean by that is there can be the shiny, sparkly part that has you feel like, oh, this would be a perfect place for me. What are the things that you would ask a potential resident to really consider before they make a move to hang out with the teachers or the nuns or whatever the group affiliation is?
Right. I would, again, it's about care management. It's about aging in place. It's about, there may be a lot of nuns or teachers, whatever, but what are the activities? Not all nuns like to do the same things, and not all teachers are affiliated in the same way. So really getting, we always say that it's great when you're going to tour a community, go at a mealtime. That's a couple of different reasons. First of all, like on a cruise ship, food is very important to people. Second, you get to see the entire population of the community together. So you see how you fit into the general, you know, residency of the community. And then the third is you get to see how the staff interacts with the residents, and are they laughing? What are the relationships like? So really to do that, experience a meal, take a look at their activity schedule, meet with the medical director, ensure that, you know, if you've got some early cognitive issues and you know that, you know, that likely cognitive issues, dementia, Alzheimer's are going to be an issue for you, ensure that you really understand their programming and how that transition will work. When would you have to move apartments, or would you? All of those things are really important.
Sue, just for the record, my mom and I have done the tour, so we are set. I just wanted you to know that I walk the talk here.
I'm very happy.
Whew. Sue, thanks for your time.
You as well. Have a great day.
Sue Johansson is Vice President of Partner Services at A Place for Mom, and she was here to talk to us about some of the themed retirement residences that are becoming more of a thing. Time for the Moolala questionnaire. So this is our series of questions about money that are, it's modeled basically after the Proust questionnaire in Vanity Fair magazine. And we learned some really cool things about our guests. Today, it is Melissa Shin. She is editorial director at Advisors Edge and investment executive. Hello there.
Hello.
You have no idea what you've gotten yourself into. You'll be great. Here we go. How would you describe your money personality?
Anal.
And was it always that way?
Yes. My parents helped me open my first bank account when I was like 6 years old. So I've always been really, really passionate about money. And also I'm a penny pincher for sure.
Really? And you're in a relationship, right?
I am.
How does that play out?
I think we both have good influences on each other. So I've loosened up a little bit, and he has started to understand that his spending will be tracked.
Right.
Maybe not by him, but maybe by me.
You've shown him the light.
Yes.
Here's what we learned. What is one financial behavior you're still working on, would you say? Or are you perfect?
Oh, I'm not perfect.
Okay, good. Okay, good.
Conscious spending from both sides. So as mentioned, I denied myself a lot of things for a long time. Wasn't making that much money. And also, you know, I'm the daughter of immigrants, and we certainly know the value of a dollar. So it was always important to me, and I would look at the menu and I'd always order the cheapest thing. And, you know, for a dollar, I could have the food I really wanted, but no, it's not worth
right.
it. So now it's about, I've reached a better state, I think. And again, that influence from my husband, and being able to say, actually, I can spend this money and it's okay.
Wow. You're going to trade up and get the sweet potato fries instead of just the regular fries. It's a big day. On that note, what is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Clothes.
Okay. So if you were to go out and you had, I don't know, like $500 in cash burning a drop from the sky, what would be, is it an accessory thing? Is it a shoe thing? Is it a jacket thing?
It would be a dress.
It'd be a dress. From Ted Baker. There, this, you didn't have to think about that one for 1 second. The people who know you probably are nodding like, yep, absolutely. Yep. That's what she said. What does financial freedom mean to you?
Maybe the ability to order something that's a dollar more on the menu.
Yeah. And the occasional, even more than occasional, Ted Baker dress.
Yeah. And it's just about making decisions well. And, you know, I don't think you need to be rich to have financial freedom. I think it just means understanding your money and having a handle on it.
When do you plan to retire, and what will you do? Your friends must expect you to have like a fully, not only because you're anal, but because of your job, you work, you cover the financial advice industry. So surely you have this all sorted out.
I don't know if I'll ever retire in the traditional sense. I really like working. I would like to travel more and have time to be able to do that beyond sort of a 3-week vacation every year. So it would maybe be sort of working in some stints and then retiring, quote unquote, for 6 months and then coming back and doing work.
If you were to land a huge financial windfall, I'm calling $25 million huge, what would you do with it?
I would pay off my mortgage.
Yes, which in Toronto is probably $24 million because
right.
that's just what houses cost.
And I would give some money to charity, and I would give money to my family and friends.
Mm. What is, I'm hoping I'll become a friend. What is one topic you could talk about, write about, cover every day and not get tired of it? that you just, in the broad world of personal finance or financial advice, you're like, this is the thing for me. I just am so deeply passionate about it.
Taxes.
What?
I know.
Are you crazy?
No, oh I like God. It.
Seriously.
There's a huge rabbit hole to go down.
There is. So do you file your own taxes?
I do.
Have you always filed your own taxes?
Yeah.
You've never had someone else do it?
No.
Wow. Do you want to know a secret?
Sure.
I've never filed my own taxes. Ever. Not once. I had them filed by my mom's accountant when I was 14. I was so horrified that I had to pay tax. I was infuriated and immediately got an RRSP. So I've had an RRSP since I was a child.
Nice.
What is one topic you wish you never, ever, ever had to write about, think about, or talk about again in the broad realm of personal finance? Jeez, for me, it's insurance. Oh, God, I don't want to talk about insurance.
I love all my children equally.
You love all your children. That is very diplomatic of you. Okay, one last question. If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be? I'm going to even give you a sound effect. There we go. Two snaps for you.
I would narrow the gap between what CEOs get paid and what the lowest employee gets paid.
Mm, why?
Because I don't think CEOs work that much harder than the frontline employees.
Right.
I mean, they do work harder, but sure. Not that much harder.
Yeah. Very interesting. Melissa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That is the Moolala Questionnaire with Melissa Shin, Editorial Director at Advisors Edge and Investment Executive. That is our show for today. 101 episodes. I can't even stand it. It's amazing. Now, here's a couple of ways to keep in touch with us. Subscribe to the newsletter at moolala.ca, and you'll get notice of all the stuff that I'm doing on CBC Radio, CityLine, and Prosper, the Financial Advisors Podcast. You can subscribe to that podcast on any podcast platform, and to this radio show, which becomes a podcast, on any platform out there. Tune in next time for episode 102. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.